My name is Ivan Bowden. I'm from the Bible College of Queensland. My favourite cartoon character is Calvin of Calvin and Hobbes fame. Does anybody share my delight in that particular cartoon strip? Most people do not know that Calvin is named after the reformer of the 16th century, John Calvin. And Hobbes, his pet tiger, is named after the British philosopher Thomas Hobbes, who lived in the 16th and 17th centuries. Here is a cartoon depicting Calvin and Hobbes, which is relevant to our topic this afternoon. Calvin has set up a stall on the side of the road, and his pet tiger asks, "How's business?" Calvin replies, "Terrible." "That's hard to believe," says Hobbes. "Calvin, I can't understand it. Everybody I know needs what I'm selling." Now, if you're able to read the sign in front of the little stall, it reads, "A swift kick in the butt for a dollar." "Everybody needs it. Can anybody finish but?" "Nobody wants it." Exactly. They all need it, but they don't want it. Now, this seminar is about needs analysis. And that cartoon illustrates two kinds of needs. Would anybody like to hazard a guess at what two kinds of needs are depicted in that cartoon strip? Anyone?
Well, the fellow selling, he needs to sell it.
Yes.
And he believes it's good for him.
Right, that's true. Anyone else? Yeah, he does. He may be quite right, though, in thinking that they all do need it. He's probably quite right also that they don't want it. There are two kinds of needs depicted in that cartoon. The first is felt needs. And the second is real needs. Calvin believes that everybody he knows has a real need for a swift kick in the butt. But nobody has a felt need for it. Now, these are actually technical terms from educational literature, and they've been defined like this. A felt need is what people want. The good thing about felt needs is that they motivate. How many of you have ever attended, say, an adult education course, or as an adult you've done some kind of correspondence course and completed it? Could I see your hand? Put your hand up. Alright, why did you take those courses? What was the course that you took, Pam?
I took Braille.
You took Braille. Mm-hmm. Why did you take it?
Because I
could
read print.
So you had a need to know how to read Braille. Mm-hmm. You had a felt need for reading Braille, and that motivated you to take the course. Somebody else, what course did you take? Anybody else? What course did you take?
Well, the last one, I did a degree in nursing.
Why did you?
I didn't need to, but I felt.
Yeah.
I believe.
Yes.
That in a senior position you should be at least as well educated as the one coming into the
Okay, so you wanted to be sufficiently educated to have credibility.
Yes.
So that word want and the idea of felt needs, they go together. A felt need is what people want. Years ago, I wanted to be able to play the piano accordion. I didn't go to formal lessons, but I got hold of a piano accordion and I worked at it until I could get a decent tune out of it. I've learned to type. How many of you have learned to type without going to classes? Because in an age of computers, you've almost got to know how to type. In other words, when we have a felt need for something, we are motivated to work on it. However, if you only address felt needs in the church, you may entertain but do very little good in the church. If I were to ask, say, the members of the congregation at our church, what would you like to be taught in the coming year? They might say, I'd like to learn how to become a millionaire, or I'd like to learn how to run a 4-minute mile, and on and on. Now, that's not likely. I'm taking way out illustrations. That's not really the job of the church. People may crowd to the course on how to become a millionaire, but we would not be doing the greatest by them. We wouldn't be serving them best. So felt needs on their own are not adequate. Let's go to the next type of need, real needs. Real needs represent the gap between things as they are and things as they ought to be. In Calvin's terms, he felt that people needed to have a good swift kick in the butt. They hadn't got one, and so there was a gap between where they were and where they ought to be. And he felt that a kick in the butt would help them. Now, suppose I want to learn to ride a bicycle, and I haven't a clue about riding a bicycle. Well, I'm going to need to know how to mount that bicycle and how to stay balanced on that bicycle and how to steer that bicycle and how, perhaps even how to repair that bicycle if I get a flat tire. So there's a gap between what I know about riding a bicycle now and the things I need to know or ought to know if I'm going to be able to ride the bicycle. Now, filling that gap is meeting that real need. When you combine the two, you have what's called an educational need. So somebody who has a felt need and a real need has an educational need. Now, the good thing about educational needs is that if you target them, say, in the teaching program of your local church, you're not only going to do good because the people have a real need, but they will be motivated to come and listen to the teaching because they have a felt need for it. So you're on a winner whenever you address educational needs, because people not only need it, but they want it, and therefore they'll be motivated to learn. Now, before we go any further, I want to turn to the scriptures to show you that the concept of needs analysis is biblical. I've got two computers set up here, and later we're going to see how they can be used in needs analysis. But there are some people who feel that it's perhaps unspiritual to engage in needs analysis, and so I want to diffuse that attitude by showing you from the scriptures that the concept of needs analysis is biblical. And we're going to look firstly at Paul's first letter to the Corinthians, and I want to ask this question: why did Paul write what he wrote in this letter to the Corinthians? Why did he say all those things about spiritual gifts and about marriage and about conduct at the Lord's table and about meat offered to idols? Why did he put that in that letter to the Corinthians? Any suggestions? They needed it. Yes. They needed it. But the question is, how did Paul know that they needed it? Well, here are some of the ways in which he found out about their needs. In chapter 1, we're told that certain members of the household of Chloe had told him of the divisions that existed in the church. So he addresses that in his letter. The grapevine in chapter 5 verse 1 had told him about a serious case of incest in the church. So he addressed that. The Corinthians had written a letter. It's mentioned in chapter 7 verse 1. And in that letter they raised a number of issues which Paul addresses from chapter 7 on. Also, he was visited by three gentlemen, Stephanus, Fortunatus and Achaicus, and they would have brought news of the condition in the church as well. Now, Paul didn't write the same material to the Galatians. Why didn't he? They didn't need it. What did they need? Well, they needed to be corrected with respect to the false teaching of the Judaizers. So that letter corrects that error. He wrote something different to the Thessalonians because they had different needs. In fact, I suspect most, if not every one, of Paul's letters was written with the specific needs of the congregations that he addressed in mind. Let's go to another letter. We'll go to Thessalonians. In chapter 3 and verse 5 of 1 Thessalonians, we read this. When I could stand it no longer, I sent to find out about your faith. But Timothy has just now come to us from you and has brought good news about your faith. Paul had been tossed out of Thessalonica after but a few weeks of ministry there. However, he left behind a group of believers. But down in the south in Corinth, he's worried about them. Are they standing firm in spite of the persecution? So he sends Timothy to find out how they're going. And it almost seems as if the moment Timothy walked through the door, Paul sat down and wrote the letter, because he now knows how things stand up there at Thessalonica. Now I want you to notice in particular what Paul says in chapter 3 and verse 10. Listen as I read. Night and day we pray most earnestly that we may see you again and supply what is lacking in your faith. Now, did you notice the word lacking? Supply what is lacking. A lack is a gap. A lack represents a need. Paul has learnt how things are. He knows how they ought to be, and he wants to fill that gap. And that's why he's writing the letter. Let's go to 2 Timothy. In 2 Timothy chapter 4 and verse 2, we have Paul's injunction to Timothy, preach the word. Why does he tell Timothy to preach the word? Because people need the word. Do you believe that? Do they want it? Not always. He says, the time will come when men will not put up with sound doctrine. Instead, they'll go here and there to have their ears tickled, to be entertained. In other words, Paul is saying, Timothy, they need the word, so you must give it to them. Even if they don't want it, you must give it to them. That's a challenge for all of our churches. Samuel talks about a famine for the word of the Lord. And I think that that is true of today's church in many quarters. So often people go to be entertained in church. And I think as churches grow, often this is the way things go. People attend a spiritual concert. They enjoy the music. And they enjoy the testimonies and perhaps the dramas and other things. And I'm not against any of those things. But we are robbing people if we do not give them the word. And even if they don't want it, we have got to somehow motivate them to want it. And one of the greatest challenges for today's church is to make people want what they need. I did some research recently with four denominations. A Baptist church, which to ensure anonymity, I've called Bethany Baptist. A Brethren Church, which we'll call Berea Brethren. A Presbyterian Church, Philippi Presbyterian. And an Assembly of God Church, Antioch AOG. Now they are real churches with fictitious names. I asked 50 questions of those churches. 15 questions on Bible. 15 on doctrine. 10 on missions. And 10 on ethics. I'm going to ask my wife if she could pass those out. I'd like these back again. But here are the 50 questions which were asked of those people. About 145 people in all. Now, you didn't hear the word Churches of Christ mentioned, did you?
No.
But we're coming to them. I do have some data on a Church of Christ congregation. By the way, please feel free to interrupt with questions. You're allowed to disagree even. So I'd like some interaction. Now, now you can see on the screen a graph. It looks rather higgledy-piggledy, so let me tell you what it's all about. On the left-hand side are four columns representing the percentage of real need in the four denominations with respect to Bible. In other words, when the test was given to these four churches, if people got less than 10 out of 15, they were regarded as having a real need. Now, the first church, the Baptist Church, has over 30%. So more than 30% of the Baptist sample had a real need in Bible. When we come to the Brethren Church, it was up over 60%. The AOG Church was about 37%. The Presbyterian Church was about 64%. Now that is alarming. When we come to the doctrine questionnaire, there were 15 questions. Again, if they got fewer than 10 correct, they were regarded as having a gap which constituted a real need, a significant real need rather. Now, in the Baptist Church, about 14%, in the Brethren Church, 28%, in the AOG, about 29 or 30, in the Presbyterian Church, 60% almost. Got fewer than 10 out of 15 correct. Now you may say, well, what were these questions all about? Well, you have them in front of you. So let's have a look at some of the Bible questions. If you turn to is there a copy of that? Oh, it's all right. All right, while they're fiddling with the climate control, we will proceed. If you turn to page 2 of the folder, you will see the questions on Bible. Number 7 reads, central to the book of Romans is Paul's explanation of how A, B, C, D, and people had to circle one of those letters. Now I want you to notice that this question is not asking how many disciples did Jesus have, or who killed Goliath, or what's the first book in the Bible. This question indicates whether or not people have a grasp of one of the most important books in the New Testament. Wouldn't you agree? Well, now let's see how they performed. Here we have the theme of Romans. In the Baptist sample, 11% did not know what the theme was. 21% of the Brethren, 6% of the AOG, but Presbyterians, 37%, which was surprising given the reformed nature of their theology and their love of things like justification and so on. Now, I wonder, I guess you've all had a go at answering the question. The correct answer was A. I hope you all got it. Let's go to another question. Turn over the page. Number 10 says the words "you must be born again" are recorded in Matthew, Mark, Luke or John. Well, 34% of the Baptists didn't know that, 35% of the Brethren, 39% of the AOG, 46% of the Presbyterian. Now, it's not the end of the world if you don't know that, but I suspect that we are bordering on biblical illiteracy if we don't know our way around the Bible well enough to point out such an important truth as that in the Scriptures. How are we going to help people to faith in Christ if we don't know our Bibles adequately for such a task? Now, go to the doctrine section and let's see how people shaped up there. Go to page 4. Look at question 1. It's question 16 actually on your sheet. What do you understand by the doctrine of the Trinity? And I've given 4 options, only one of which is correct. There is one God who exists in 3 divine persons. There is one God who manifests himself at different times as Father, Son and Holy Spirit. There are 3 gods, Father, Son and Holy Spirit. There are 3 persons who, when combined, make up one God. Now, here are the results. The Trinity, 16% of the Baptists, 26% of the Brethren, 21% of the AOG, 44% of the Presbyterians. Not get the question correct about one of the central teachings of the Christian faith. That is very serious indeed, in my opinion. Now, I don't know how the Churches of Christ would have shaped up on that. It would be interesting, and you might like to check it out. I suspect there are a few people with Jehovah's Witness teaching, or Sabellian teaching, an ancient heresy of the early centuries. Let's take another situation. This time we'll go to the doctrine of justification. It's on page 5. What does the term justification mean in the New Testament? Being made righteous by God, being declared righteous by God, being forgiven, becoming more holy. Now, this was a more difficult question because you can sense that the distinction between questions A and B is fairly fine. But the distinction is more important than you might think. Roman Catholics teach that A is the correct answer. They are wrong. Justification doesn't make us righteous. It simply says that we are declared righteous by God and we now stand in the clear as far as his law and justice are concerned. Now, look at the results. 46% of the Baptists did not know. 76% of the Brethren, 42% of the AOG and 70% of the Presbyterian group. Now, these are not fictitious results. They are real people in the Brisbane area. Let's go now to a different topic. We'll go to the topic of missions. And if you turn to page 6, you will see question 35 reads, "Those who have never heard the gospel are not lost until they hear and reject it." Now, I think you can sense that that question has a bearing on missions. Because we ought to cancel all missionary activity if that is true. Or take the next question, 36. Those who die without ever having heard the gospel will have an opportunity for salvation after death. If that is true, we ought to cancel all missionary activity because these people are better off to die without hearing the gospel, because I can't imagine anybody rejecting the gospel after they die, because they'll know there's an afterlife. And they'll know what the options are, and they'll certainly accept Christ. Well, now, let's see how people responded. A chance for salvation after death, 48% of the Baptists, 26% of the Brethren, 51% of the AOGs, and 46% of the Presbyterians think there will be a chance for salvation after death. Let's look at some ethical issues. One of the topical ethical issues before us in the media is the issue of voluntary euthanasia. We've already had an example of it in the Northern Territory. Go to page 7, where you have 10 ethical issues. You may not agree with my response to these 10 issues, but if you look at number 48, you will see a question about euthanasia. Active as against passive euthanasia. We're not just turning off a life support system here, we're injecting them with poison, right? active euthanasia is an acceptable option in the case of an elderly person who has a fatal disease causing extreme and continuous pain and who wishes to die. I would say that is exactly the situation that occurred in the Northern Territory just recently. As a Christian, I think we ought to disagree with that. Now, you can have your own opinion. I personally think we ought to disagree with it. Let's see what the churches felt. 32% of the Baptists felt it was okay to inject this person. 23% of the Brethren, 15% of the AOGs, 37% of the Presbyterians. Let's take the issue of divorce for incompatibility. 25%, 23%, 24%, 44% of the Presbyterians. Abortion in the case of rape is okay for 48% of the Baptists. Well, now, there may be differences in this group on those issues. I'm not here to debate the issues. The point is that if we are going to address ethical issues, we're going to have greater authority if we know where people stand, because we can then determine, is there a gap between their present situation and a biblical or a Christian situation. Suppose as a pastor you were going to give a series of talks on, say, abortion or homosexuality or whatever. You could have some very useful data if you did a needs analysis to find what people's views presently were. I did this in the case of a Church of Christ. So it's your turn now. You've been gloating over the Baptists and the Presbyterians. Well, let's have a look at a Church of Christ. The pastor of this church is thoroughly evangelical and committed to the Scriptures. Faithfully teaches them. Here are three of the missions questions that we have in that sheet before you. Question one, those who have never heard the gospel are not lost until they hear and reject it. Over 60% agreed with that. So 60% of this particular Churches of Christ congregation felt that these people are not lost. Well, I would say let's keep them in ignorance. Let's not tell them the gospel, because if they hear it and reject it, they've had it. Look at the next question. People will have an opportunity for salvation after death. There were nearly 20% who felt that is true. They agree with it. Number three, because God is a God of love, everybody will get to heaven in the end, about 17% there. Now, think of what that means. This is the doctrine of universalism. This means Adolf Hitler will get to heaven. All of the Hindus, Muslims, Buddhists will all get to heaven. Your atheist neighbour will get to heaven. Well, stop witnessing to him. Don't send any more missionaries if everybody's going to go to heaven. Well, nearly 20% of a Church of Christ congregation thinks that that's the way things are. I think there's a need there. Now, in order to engage in needs analysis, I have been working on a computer program, and here again, people can get nervous, and they can think, oh, we're now importing the world's business methods into the church. Get rid of that notion. You wouldn't object to the speaker at this conference having a microphone to amplify his voice so that the people in the back row could hear it. Well, we're using electronics to advance the cause of Christianity, and that's all we're doing when we use a computer. We're just speeding up the process. Some years ago I did research in these different denominations and found great help from a program produced by the World Health Organization. Quite a powerful program for medical research. I wrote to them and asked if I could adapt the program for Christian purposes, and they said yes, go ahead. So I demedicalized it to a large extent and I Christianized it, and it is now called CNA, or Church Needs Analysis, and the people on that side of the room can see the opening screen there, and I hope you folk here can see this screen. Now, what I'm going to do is to show you the process of analysing needs using this program, or you can do it without the program. But there are a number of stages. The first stage is to ask the question, what is the issue? Now, in the case of the Church of Christ that we've been looking at, I was invited to speak at their Missions Day. And the pastor and I got together and we said, well, what do we want to know? Now, this particular church has had a missionary pledge system of giving to missions. And so a questionnaire was devised to find out whether people liked it, whether they understood it, whether those who participated in it had managed to achieve their goal, and so on. And as well, we threw in some theological questions such as, is universalism true, are the heathen lost, etc. And you've seen some of those results, but not all of them. So stage one was, what is the issue? Now, the issue in your church might be very different. I was talking to a Baptist pastor in Tasmania, and he raised the issue of car parking. And we came up with a very simple questionnaire that might have been very relevant to his church. Here's the questionnaire. Is parking a problem when you attend church? Yes or no? How often do you attend church? Twice each Sunday, morning service only, etc. How many people regularly travel in your vehicle? And number four, where do you usually park? A, B, C, or D? Now, the data that comes out of a questionnaire like that may guide the diaconate or the governing board of the church in knowing whether to extend the car park or to have a carpooling program or whatever. Now, that's not a very spiritual exercise, but it does represent a need which needs to be analysed. The next stage in the needs analysis is to ask, what do I need to know in order to address the issue? Well, I've given you an example from the car parking one. I need to know how many services. There's no point in extending a new car park for the people who only come once a year, right? I need to know how many people are travelling in each car, etc. So what do I need to know to address the issue? Thirdly, you need to construct the questionnaire. And that's where the computer is very, very useful. In the case of the car park one, you construct the questionnaire with a number of codes which become data entry points. So let's illustrate this. I'll get my wife to cooperate with me here. We will go into the programs by pressing P. Now, when you press P, up come a number of programs. To create the questionnaire, you would press C. So we'll press C. Press P and then C. Now, you have a blank screen in front of you. Now, if I press F2 and then enter and then enter again, I get a list of files. And we're going to press C until we go down to the C's, and with our arrow key, we will go down to Church of Christ, CH of CH. Got a problem? Okay, we'll just press escape and F10. Where are you now?
Beginning.
Okay, we'll just leave that for the moment. I'll go out to where you are too. We'll start again. Let's go into S for samples and then D for data files. Now, we'll press B for Bible and up will come the questionnaire that you looked at a moment ago for the Bible. Do you all see that on the screen? Now, you hand out your questionnaires on pieces of paper. That's the simplest thing in the form that I've given you there. You ask people after church to take 5 minutes to fill that in, and then the secretary enters the data in here. And once it's in there, we can go to this stage here of analysing the data. And that's where the computer comes into its own. Now, we'll see if we can pick up there. If you press F10, go back to P for programs, A for analyze, and then type in read ch of ch. Is that working? Yes, press enter. Alright. No, we've got a problem on that side of the room. I'll see if I can. Church of Christ, how are we going? We up the top we should see 87 records. Showing at the top. What's it saying? Alright, just what's it saying? Of CH. Press enter. What's happening? Okay, well, just leave that for a moment. We've now entered all of the records that were filled in by the Church of Christ, and there are 87 of them. Now, when I press F3, I get a list of, I'll show you later if I can. I get a list of all the questions in very abbreviated form. When I press F2, I get a list of all the commands that I can activate in relation to the data that we've entered in. For example, suppose I wanted to see what I've put in a graph there, which shows me that most people in the church understand the concept of the giving system of that particular church, but a small portion do not. Now, I won't go into this in any more detail because it's hard for some of you to see, but we'll take a few minutes at the end for you to just stand around the computer and we can ask questions, etc. But what the computer will allow you to do is to get percentages of people who think like Jehovah's Witnesses or who agree with the Orthodox position on the Trinity, or the percentage of people who come once a year to church or who like the first service or whatever. Now, so that we can all be looking at the same thing, let's press F10 and go back to the main screen. You're back there. Now press S for samples, D for data. Now go down to C for church, and then S for survey. Now here we have a survey which could be used in any church, or it could be adapted to meet your needs. Remember that all of the samples on this program are purely samples. The real strength of this computer program is that you can create the questionnaires which will target the needs in your particular situation, whether it's a boys brigade or an evening service or youth group, or you know, do people want to have more worship, do they like choruses or hymns or whatever. You can ask any kinds of questions you like. Now here is a church life survey. For example, which Sunday service do you prefer to attend? Press enter. And you come to question two. If you answered A, B or C in the first question, why do you like that service? Press page down. Here's another question. Which groups in the church need help? Now suppose you found that 85% of your congregation felt that the singles over 25 needed help. I think you need a singles ministry in your church. Page down again. Which topics would you like teaching in? I think a lot of pastors go away on retreat at Christmas time to plan their next year's preaching topics, often without finding out where the needs are. What is the point of my taking a series of 20 weeks on Ezekiel if all the marriages in our congregation are falling apart and people are desperately needing help in establishing a Christian home? Let's go down to a page. Here's a threatening one. How would you rate the preaching in the church? From never to always, biblically based, relevant to today's world, well prepared, presented, etc. Well, most pastors would dodge that one, so we'll go down a page. How would you rate the music in the church? Is it at the right volume, glorifying to God, appropriate to the occasion, presented by suitably gifted people, and so on? Well, I won't keep going. Now, all of these are simply samples. But if you're going to make decisions as churches, then you need to do it on the basis of information. After all, suppose you were thinking of giving women in the congregation more responsibility for leading worship, and a survey showed that 99% of the congregation were against the idea, you may have a very serious split on your hands. Some kind of feedback is important if you're going to make decisions. Well, now, I've gone on quite long enough. I want to pause at this juncture in order for you to ask questions and to explore this a bit further. So would anybody like to start the ball rolling?
Come back to the early time, you talked about physical knowledge of the Bible.
Yes.
And you ask all these questions. Doesn't it come back to the sole purpose of the church in small groups, where the Christians are taught what the basic importance of the Bible and of Christ's doctrine was? And if it is taught, then the nucleus of the church then spreads out into the outer circles of the church life, so they may in turn teach the word?
Well, I think your question is about church structures, and certainly in the New Testament, Christians tended to meet in houses. I don't think that was a law laid down for every generation. I think every generation and every culture has got to determine what is going to be best for them. I remember reading a book years ago, a booklet called The Lost Secret of Church, which was all about this, getting back into houses. I think a lot of churches are doing that through their home groups, etc. Whether the teaching, though, takes place within those small groups primarily or in the larger congregational settings of the church, I think is something that has to be determined at the local church level. I think the issue of whether we teach is not a negotiable one, though. We're told to preach the word. Jesus commanded us to go into all the world and make disciples of all nations, teaching them whatever I've spoken to you. So we can't argue about whether we want to teach. I think we could debate as to where that teaching is done and where it's done most effectively. But certainly small groups are a good way of teaching. There's no doubt about that. Anyone else?
Is this program sale?
Yes. It's $50. For postage, that's a discount price if you like. If you're here now, you were to get it by post, it'd be $55. And what I've done is I've brought a brochure which has some of the information that I've been talking about, and if you'd like one of the brochures, just take one and pass the rest on. Or if you can use more than one, by all means take more than one. But I've included there the biblical basis for needs analysis that we've been talking about, so that you can follow that up. And there is an application form on the back if you're interested in looking at this further. It will go on any DOS-based machine from about DOS 2 up, so most machines will take it. But let's continue talking about this question of needs analysis. Any other points that people would like to raise?
Yes, before a church leadership embarks on a new direction, they should actually questioning.
Well, whether you do it formally or informally is up to the church. If your church is only 10 people, then you can do it fairly informally. If your church is 200 people, then a computer will greatly help you. Because one of the things that a computer can do, which is very difficult by hand, is this. I would normally recommend that you put, say, a sex factor, male or female question, and even a band, age band question. Now, what the computer can do very readily is it can find out what the over 60s think about the issue, what the under 20s think about the issue, what the men think of the issue, what the women think of the issue. You can set it up so that people with a university degree who are under 30 years of age, who are married with three children, you can do it in all sorts of ways. A computer can find all that sort of information out for you if you've asked the right question. So I think the more important the decision to be made, the more important that you have good information upon which to make it. That would be my advice. If it's a question of whether to paint the toilet block blue or red, well, you don't need a great big questionnaire. Just give it to the property maintenance committee. But if it's a question of should we spend $100,000 extending this church,
I think you need to know what the people are thinking, because they're the ones who are going to have to pay for it. They're the ones who are going to have to turn up to the working bees.